The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with Laura Lippman, and we're here for an hour together. By the way, the next hour coming up, we remain in kind of a journalistic mode, though Laura's not a journalist anymore, when you'll hear an interesting conversation about a new biography of I.F. Stone, one of the few people I have who's a hero in the world of journalism. But that's next hour. This hour, we have Laura Lippman with us. She is a award-winning author, came out of Baltimore, grew up in Baltimore. Her Tess Monahan series has just taken off around the world. She's written now 11, 14?
Tess 10. And then four other books.
And her latest work is Life Sentences, also centered here in Baltimore. Laura, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Really good to see you. This book, I just love this book. First of all, before we get into this book, I want to hear how how that serial started in the New York Times Magazine.
The serial started in the New York Times Magazine. It was called The Girl in the Green Raincoat. And what happened was, last March, the publicist with whom I work at my publisher sent me a note saying, someone at the New York Times Magazine wants your email. May I share it? And I thought, oh my goodness, I think they're going to ask me to write this serialized novella. They'd been doing it for a while. And I was on tour for last year's book. I was writing what would become Life Sentences. I had more than enough on my plate. And sure enough, they did ask me. And the first thing I did was I sent emails to two writers who had done it. And I was really hoping they would tell me, nah, you don't have to do it. It's not that big a deal. And they both came back and said, you're crazy if you don't do this. The story of the girl in the green raincoat, which begins on page one with Tess Monahan 7 months pregnant and confined to bed rest, is a story I've had in the back of my head for a really long time. And it was inspired by a story that my sister once outlined years ago. She doesn't even remember this, or but she had once said, oh, you should write a book about a woman in an isolated place who has broken her leg or something, has limited movement. And somehow in my head, that had changed and turned into this story about a Rear Window homage in which Tess Monahan is incapacitated but sees something out the window. It's also an homage to a book called Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, which is about...
I love that book.
Oh, it's an amazing book. It's about a detective who is recovering from, I believe it's a surgery, and he decides he's going to solve the mystery of the princes in the tower from Richard, it's Richard III, right? And he, just lying in his bed, goes over all the information that's available and decides what really happened. So very conscious homage to both of those things. And I knew it was going to be tough. I mean, I would get up every morning for a while there, probably about five months or so, and I would work on Life Sentences in the morning, and then I'd come back in the late afternoon and work on The Girl in the Green Raincoat. And it had to be, each section had to be the same length, more or less. You know, there's no real flexibility. I got 15 parts. I had to outline pretty extensively before I did it, which is not something I normally do, but the parameters were such that I had to know exactly what I was doing. And I loved doing it. I loved writing The Girl in the Green Raincoat. It was, it became almost like one enormous inside joke for all the people who'd been reading the Tess Monahan books, because all of these characters that have figured through the series come through Tess's, I don't want to call it her sick room, but through the sun porch where she's, and they all end up telling her stories. And it turns out, you know, she doesn't really know how her parents met and fell in love. Her father tells her that story, and she hears the love story of this older woman who works for her, and she gets drawn into the youthful romance of this boy named Lloyd. And it was just, it was a blast. It was a really fun piece to write, And, you know, normally I don't look back and say, oh, that was fun.
You really did enjoy this,
but
didn't you?
I really did. I really did. And because I knew where it was going, and I felt that it was just, it was such a kick to work in the serial form. And it was very different. And I'm and also I say, and it got me a new kitchen. The first page of the serial is matted and framed, and it hangs on the wall in the kitchen that it paid for. And I used to tell people, so I think the editor at the New York Times, I think she's talking to my contractor because he seems to have an eerie knowledge of exactly how much I can afford.
That's great. That's great. That's good. You can do that. That's great. So, I mean, and so did you, so if you're writing that at the same time you're writing What Became Life Sentences, which is this new novel we'll talk about today, among other things. How hard was that to compartmentalize with Cassandra and company in the morning and then have to take a break and come back to?
You know, I've never really thought about this until just this minute, but I think part of the reason I enjoyed writing The Girl in the Green Raincoat so much is because that centers on Tass, who's an old friend to me by now,
right,
and who, in my eyes, is an immensely likable person. You know, the main character in Life Sentences is many things. Likeable is not a word that comes to mind.
Right.
It was considered a little daring to write a book that centers on someone who's so unlikable. But I don't, I think you probably have friends like this. I know people like this who are interesting and charismatic and fascinating and can even be great company. They totally wear you out.
Yes, completely. Yes, yes.
And that's the kind of person Cassandra is. I was firm in my belief that she was interesting enough that readers would get past the fact that she wasn't particularly sympathetic. And I thought it was important to the book that she not be sympathetic, because the quest that she's on and the discoveries that she's going to make and the decisions she's ultimately going to have to make, I think they're more meaningful for the reader because they don't like Cassandra very much.
Mm-hmm.
Because for readers, because they don't like Cassandra. If you like Cassandra, then you're going to approve of everything she does, or you're going to sympathize with everything she does. If you don't like her, you're going to have to stand back and sort of evaluate her principles and decide whether or not you respect the decision she reaches on intellectual ground. It's not about liking her. It's about whether you can see what she learns at the end. She learns a lot over the course of this book.
She does.
She's a more likable person at the end of the book,
yep.
But it's a long road to get there.
And it's interesting that her antagonists throughout the book, many of the women that she grew up with as a little girl,
mm-hmm.
Begin to define that character for you as you're, they unfold her.
Yes, they show her, you know, the character of Cassandra is a very successful memoir writer. She's used to defining the story. She's used to defining herself. She has...
And others.
And others. Primarily herself, who she seems to find herself the most interesting of all the people she's written about. And she's not used to people talking back to her. She's gotten a lot of approval for her nonfiction, not so much for her fiction, which is why she's come back to nonfiction. She's used to people having nice things to say about her and her insights and her candor. And it's quite a shock to come back to Baltimore and find out that there are all these people who have intimate knowledge of the things that she's written about, and they're not quite as enraptured as her mm-hmm. millions of readers worldwide.
Well, that's interesting because I think she's, I mean, it's, I was just thinking about this, I was playing with some words, and the whole book here is like playing with words in a lot of ways. I mean, because you, Life Sentences could be, it's a, everything you do here is like a play on words, a play on the theme. Life sentences, sentences of life, sentences about life. I mean, it's how you keep throwing in all the references to Greek mythology and twisting that through the story.
Yes.
I like these layers.
Thank you.
that you created for us here. But it's also about, in some ways, how we, none of us can get history right. None of us can get our own personal history right, our own stories. How they take on a life of their own, even when they're not real.
Absolutely. This book is rooted in so many different places. I mean, I can probably rattle off like a half dozen important seminal events that went into writing this book. One of the primary ones happened in April of 2005. I can date it exactly because my husband and I were en route to opening day for the Washington Nationals. Baseball had just returned to Washington. And
that's right, he's a Bethesda boy.
Yes, I'm married to David Simon, as a lot of people know. And he had grown up as a huge and fervent fan of the Washington Senators. And on the way to the game that day, we were with some friends of his from childhood. He started talking about being a kid and smuggling a transistor radio into school to listen to the opening day game. And he sneaked down to the lavatory around the time the game would be winding up. And it's his favorite player, Mike Epstein, the only Jewish player, mm-hmm. comes to bat. And David prays to God that Mike Epstein, the score's tied, it's the bottom of the ninth, the bases are loaded, and he prays to God and asks God to let Mike Epstein get a hit. And he's facing a very famous pitcher. I always get this part of the story wrong. He was either facing Catfish Hunter or Vida Blue, but one of the big pitchers right. of the day. And he prays to God. He says, God, please let Mike Epstein get a hit. And if you do that, I promise I will be better about going to Hebrew school. I will be a better Jewish boy, and I will do better in preparing for my bar mitzvah. And this is a promise that he would go on to break within weeks. But as he remembered it, Mike Epstein not only got a hit, he had a home run, a grand slam to win the day in a particularly glorious way. And I'd heard this story a couple of times before this particular day, but one of his friends, one of the people he'd grown up with, a guy named Daryl Bagella, says, I don't think so. He said, what do you mean? He said, you know, I went to every opening day. My dad always got tickets. And no, I'd remember that. That never happened. And it didn't happen, not on opening day. I don't think...
Did it ever happen?
I don't think Epstein ever hit a grand slam in his career. After some research, David found a game where Epstein gets, maybe it's the go-ahead run or sort of bats in the go-ahead run, and that ends up being the final score, and it's the sixth inning, and it's not the bottom of the ninth, and it's June, and it's not opening day. and I mean, all of the details that made it such a great story kind of fell away. I mean, the story was still essentially true. I still believe that he prayed and that he would break that promise to God in a matter of weeks, which is the main thrust of the story. But it got me thinking, because we all have stories like this that we tell over and over and over again. And I don't think most of us consciously embroider or make them false. We let certain details go because they don't serve us well. They're just complicated and, you know, they don't matter. But we tell these stories over and over again, and they define us on some level.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, gosh, what happens if you've got one of these stories that defines you and you find out it's essentially false? And that's...
Cassandra.
Yeah. You know, Cassandra has spent her entire life defining herself through a series of stories, and it's never occurred to her to really think about them. And it's what's never occurred to us that these stories have much larger meaning, even if her version is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that are, you know, the story of Cassandra's life is that her father left her for a woman he met during the 68 riots. And one of Cassandra's friends basically says, you know, it was kind of bigger than that, you know? A city was burning down. An important man had been assassinated. Your father's romantic history is not the central story of that weekend in April in 1968. The fact that he never came home with your birthday cake is not the historic event. There is a lot more in play. And you know, Cassandra does not get that for a long time. She does not get that she has taken something very important and kind of minimized it.
For her own story.
Right. That she's made her own personal right. story bigger than this really important historical event.
Laura Lippman is in the studio, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Her latest novel is what we're talking about, Life Sentences, 410-319-8888. But this, it's the other layers of stories in here. I mean, you chose to do something which is not easy to do. And I mean as, well, whether you're a writer or an actor, you kind of, in those ways, or a screenwriter or a novelist, you put yourself in places and put dialogue in your head and on the page that, or in your mouth, that don't belong to you. They come from some other place. That's the nature of being a writer or an actor or whatever. You embody something different. But you, this is an area that you grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Comes out of Dickeyville on the west side of Baltimore, which is where you grew up.
Yes.
And you put her in the situation with her best friends in elementary school, all of whom are black, and go into their lives as adults. But you really do it in a way that I've found a lot of, I'll just put it on the table here, that a lot of white writers have not been able to do.
Well, thank you. I mean,
In a kind of nuanced way that you don't see often.
I think that's, you know, here's the thing. If you live in Baltimore and you happen to be white and you write about an all-white world, and it's possible to do. I mean, you know, if you keep the world small enough, you can create all white stories within Baltimore. There are stories within the Tess Monahan series where race is not that central.
Right.
But if you're going to write about the city, you can't just write about white people. You just can't. I mean, that's really, if the city is your subject, I mean, the mere fact of setting your stories in Baltimore does not necessarily, I don't think Baltimore is Ann Tyler's subject. I think Ann Tyler would be one of our greatest writers in any city in the United
right.
States. If she'd stayed in her native Minneapolis.
She just happens to live here in Baltimore.
Yeah. And Baltimore is not her subject. Baltimore is my subject. And that means that I have to come back to race every so often. You know, 2 years ago, I wrote a book called What the Dead Know, had virtually no racial overtones whatsoever. It was very small. It was focused on this one family, this one tragedy, and the tragedy had nothing to do with race whatsoever. This time around, the story has everything to do with race. It's about race on so many levels. Cassandra is white. Her father leaves her mother for an African-American woman. She goes to an elementary
school. In 1968.
In 1968, right. Which is a big deal. You know, there are the 68 riots. There are her friends in elementary school. I mean, I was very influenced by something that happened to me growing up in Baltimore. When we were in elementary school, and I did go to Dickey Hill Elementary, and I had a large group of friends, white and African American, we were so unself-conscious about our friendships. I don't really remember race being a big deal when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
As we moved toward junior high school and high school, it seemed to be more in the air. And there seemed to be, you know, Baltimore at that point, you know, people forget Baltimore was very late to busing. You know, the city had an open enrollment policy that kind of kept it off the hook for a very long time. You can go to school anywhere.
Right.
We don't have segregation. You know, if you can get there, you can go there. But of course, the de facto reality was schools are very segregated. In certain parts, you know, like Patterson High School was
all white.
And so perhaps that was part of it. But you know, I did have this memory of kids who had been pretty free and unselfconscious with each other. and a sense that that changed as we became teenagers, which maybe just because we became teenagers we changed. Maybe it was race. I never knew what it was. It was all sort of just very interesting to me. And I thought, well, I want to work through that in a novel. And, you know, there's these moments when you're writing a novel and you just have a morning or, you know, a moment where this line comes out and you think, okay, that's the story of this novel. And there is a line probably in the first third of the book where two of these old schoolmates of Cassandra's are talking, Tisha and Donna.
Right.
And they're sitting there talking, and Donna is from that northwest side. She's talking pre-Buppy. No one would have said Buppy, though, but she's from one of those sort of really, what's the word I'm groping
she's
for?
She's from
an upper middle class.
She's
African,
from the old African black middle class that goes back into the 19th century
right.
up till now.
Right.
Those old families.
Yeah.
Right.
She's from one of the old families. She's very sure of her place in the world. She's very confident. So she's less bothered by Cassandra and sort of the claim she's made on this historic story than her friend Tisha, who is also her sister-in-law. And Tisha is really bugged by the fact that there's an incident from their past that Cassandra has portrayed in her book as being about race. And Tisha says to Donna, white people never think anything is about race unless it's about them, and then it's always about race. And I actually remember I put that in an email and I sent it to a friend who's biracial and said, reality check, do you agree with this? And she said, oh, yeah. You know, of course. You know, she's, as someone who's biracial, she sort of gets to play both sides of the fence. And mm-hmm. I knew she would be very honest with me. And I thought, there is that oddity. On the way here today, I was listening to yet another discussion about whether the Supreme Court Justice nominee, Sotomayor, mm-hmm. is racist.
Oh, God, I'm so sick of this.
And people who want to equate her comment about being female and Latina
right.
with, they're saying, well, if you're saying these other things that other people have said over the years are racist, then you have to admit this is racist. And it's, you know, and she should withdraw from, and I was thinking, boy, you know, this disingenuous pretense that we're on some sort of level playing field mm-hmm. and that this can be equated with some of the things that white men in power have said. I mean, it may not have been the most elegantly expressed point. I think she's on to something. I mean, I think she's saying simply that she has a perspective that is lacking in other people. And it's a perspective that, so I think it's amazing to me. I mean, my personal theory is that white people are so defensive and guilt-ridden on the subject of race, as well they should be, that they can't wait to sort of find racism against them. They love it. They love the experience because it makes them feel like, wow, this African-American person was rude to me because I'm white. And that just pretty much settles the balance sheet. I had a hard time at the MVA today, and it was clearly because I was white. So, you know, history of slavery, Jim Crow laws, segregation, we are even now because I have been discriminated against. I just really see this, and I think it's hilarious. You know, I'm going to blank on his name. I think it was Andrew Hacker, really wonderful writer on mm-hmm. social policy and race. He wrote how in his college class, he would ask white students to put a price tag on how much would they want to be paid if the exchange was, you can have this amount of money, but you have to live in this country as a black person. They they could never name a price high enough. I mean, it was like you ask, you know, so you ask people, well, okay, all things are even, you know, it's all very equal. What amount of money would you want to trade being born a white person in our culture? It's just, anyway, so I do think there is this tendency. And, you know, early on when I was writing this book, it was pointed out to me that people would think I was Cassandra.
Because it's a writer you're writing
Because it's
about.
A writer, and, you know, and in my head there were all these distinctions, very fine, very subtle, but distinctions nonetheless. Then I thought about it, I said, great, fine. And counterintuitively, it made me so much freer to push her toward these boundaries where she would be unlikable, where she could be a bit dense about other people, where she could really not get things, even though she herself is so comfortable and secure in her liberal credentials. She's so sure of her own good intentions. And so I'm really glad I had that conversation, because I think it was important for the book that Cassandra not be one of those perfect liberal archetypes who always says the right thing and thinks the right thing. And
well, no, it's the nuance of these characters. I want to explore some of these characters and the nuance of this and Baltimore versus Universal in some ways in these characters. Laura Lippman's our guest. She just said a mouthful that I want to kind of think through and get back on the air with some conversation about what she just said. Number is 410-319-8888. Can we go to the phones? Yes? No? Yes? Yes. Karen in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Karen.
How are you all doing?
Well, thank you.
Thanks. I actually was thinking about what you said about stories, because I'm in my early 50s, and I have so many stories. It's amazing. Well, I've been a nurse for 32 years.
So I guess you have stories that if you have been a nurse for 32 years.
Oh, my gosh. I work last night. I have stories from last night, 32 years ago. And I love all ages from 0 to 100, but I'm finding myself, sometimes I get a little bored around young people because they really don't have very good stories unless they've had some tragedy or some difficulties. And we had a very good friend who died last week, and we spent the whole, you know, week a lot at the Shiva house because we're very close and everything. And that's, you know, the Jewish custom for people who don't know who are listening about little Mark. You know, of course, but and Laura knows, but the people who are listening, it's a custom of the mourners really being taken care of by the community for the first 7 days after a death.
Right.
And on the Jewish Sabbath, we went over in the afternoon to drink scotch and reminisce about our friend. And we had so many stories because we were all together as young married people, you know, 25, 26 years ago. And it was such a comfort to his children who are in their early 20s. I think I've heard these stories a million times. But afterwards, you know, his daughter especially said, you know, how wonderful it was that, you know, we had really known her father and loved him and had all these great stories. But I also know that I also edit. You were saying, Laura, how sometimes you leave out details, you kind of play up a certain aspect of the story, sometimes because of the listener, sometimes myself because I'm a big comedian, for comic effect. Hi, honey. My son just came home from school. I don't know. Stories are just extremely important. And then one more thing, and then I'll get off the air because I have to make dinner. But I actually didn't grow up in a very racially mixed area. I grew up in Los Angeles in the 1960s in the suburbs.
Uh-huh.
Well, really, it was white people, Jewish people, basically. And, you know, just maybe Mexican-Americans were just starting to really, you know, move in. But not like, you know, now it's very Hispanic and everything. So I came to Baltimore in the mid-'80s, and I spent most of my life here as an adult. And, well, partially because being a nurse, you know, I just see people as they are because death and illness is a great leveler. But I think over the years, I've become much less romantic about race, that all black people are this, all white people are that, because I see good and bad things in every person,
right,
in every
right.
group, because that's the way we are, you know. So, anyways, I have to go make dinner. So.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Thank you,
you
Karen, for holding on. Thank you for joining us. We'll come back to talk a bit about what Karen was saying, or the other callers calling in. We're talking to Laura Lippman, whose latest novel is Life Sentences. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be back in just a minute. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Laura Lippman is in the studio today. We're talking about many things, but focusing on her latest novel, Life Sentences, which is just a superb book that looks at Baltimore and these characters and crosses racial lines with some intensity that's just fascinating, as well as being a really interesting mystery that does not end the way you think it's going to end. At least it didn't for me. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Missy in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Missy.
Very excited to read this book. I grew up in Baltimore County in a very racially mixed area, and I'm African American. And, you know, I had lots of friends of all different races growing up, but as I moved into adulthood, some of those friendships were especially hard to maintain.
That's interesting.
And even though it was sort of an idyllic upbringing, I just found that sort of those notions that, you know, we're all the same and equal, it becomes an increasingly tense situation the older you get.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to see Ms. Lippman's point of view, because my relationships with some of my friends that I had when I was younger, those relationships are so tense that it's hard to even address, you know, why we're not close or why we don't socialize in the same way anymore.
Is it something that happens as you got older when it comes to race? Is that what happened?
I believe so. I know I have one particular friendship that the O.J. Simpson trial and the L.A. riots,
uh-huh,
sounded a death knell in that friendship. I recall when the L.A. riots were going on, I was invited to a party. I was in law school, and I was invited to a party with some of my friends from law school. You know, these are black people in law school, you know, studying to become officers of the court. And she was afraid to go with me to a party.
Sorry.
Afraid for her safety. And that really just deeply wounded me to the point where I have never really reached out or dealt with her ever again.
I think part of what happens is if we like move the conversation off of race into gender, where I think people feel a little bit safer. And if you're a woman and you want to talk about sort of large indignities that you've suffered, and you want to talk about that to the specific man in your life, the man might sit there and say, well, hey, I didn't do it, and don't hold this against me. And I think one of the problem that comes into friendships between whites and blacks is that whites want to be told, well, I'm not talking about you. And I think that's an unfair expectation. I think people should be allowed to talk about their history and their experiences without having to soothe and comfort the friend that they've sought to confide in. I mean, I think it should be understood if you're talking to your friend that you're not blaming your friend for things that have happened to you and things that you've seen, but that you still, you know, it's, again, I use the word disingenuous. For white liberals, and which, by the way, I am, but for us to say, oh, it's all fine now, all problems solved, I don't see race. I find that to be a bit much. And I do think part of the problem is that, you know, people just feel guilty and complicit. And instead of examining why they feel that way, they just want the conversation to stop.
I mean, I think what you were saying, Missy, as well, and what Laura, you were just saying, I mean, I think that there's this, something does happen. And I'm interested to explore what all this means and different levels, not what this hour, because we're talking about your book. But I mean, on the one hand, I was thinking about what Missy was just saying with her friend. I interviewed Army of One. Sarbanes. Why am I blocking her first name? This is terrible. I just saw him the other week. Paul's daughter. Anyway, come to me in a minute. I'm sorry. I do apologize for that. But anyway, in her book, she talks about growing up near where you grew up, and that friendships changed in the sixth grade over racial lines, and something parted. That something, I think, happens in kind of a consciousness that begins to grow that changes things in people's lives. And people have to make almost a conscious effort sometimes not to let them part and to bring them together. It's really that dynamic gets played out in your book.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that you have captured, one of the things that interests me is how you capture, let's say, between Tisha and Donna, those two, or any other ones in the book, Tina?
Tina, who's the white cop.
Right.
And then you have Callie herself, the mother of the missing child, who's never talked about it. And then you have Fatima. And these are all girls who knew each other. They're all about the same age. But they're not
the least bit alike. They're not alike. They're all very different human beings. And it's the class differences that are really interesting to me in these characters that you kind of hone in on. And the subtleties, even between Tish and Donna. Somebody from an old middle-class family and somebody whose parents had just broken through as civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a powerful nuance of difference between those worlds. And this crazy world that Cassandra comes from on the white side of the tracks with this father who you know who's intellectual and kind of a real oddball in his own right. I mean, it's...
The father whose black wife is never really accepted by his colleagues at the university. And no one ever knows what is that about. Is it snobbery? Is it class? Is it intellect? Is it race? But the bottom line is her father, whatever his faults, loves his second wife sincerely and passionately, and she is at the center of his life, and his friends can't accept her.
He's an interesting character.
Yes. Cedric Fallows is a very interesting character.
Very interesting character. Let me back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Laura Lippman is our guest. Her novel is Life Sentences. Rhonda, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. I am really enjoying your show, and I have to agree with your most recent caller. I'm also an African-American woman. I grew up in Harford County, Maryland in the 70s, and I remember being either the only black in my class or one of like two or three all the way through school. And the friendships definitely went through some type of strain when middle school hit. I don't know if it was because we all were becoming more aware of the differences, but it definitely happened. And now me and my classmates have all turned 40, and we've recently had some reunions, and it's been really great to see everyone. But it's clear that none of them are saying, hey, come meet my husband. Let's all hang out. Let's go and have a cookout this weekend. Why don't you come over? None of that's going on.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think that they're afraid to acknowledge my race, which is odd. But, you know, I remember a really weird incident when I was in high school where we had all African-American girls that were going to be on this, like, cheer squad or pom-pom squad.
Uh-huh.
And one of the girls was white, and she quit. And I said, why are you quitting? And she said, well, I'll be the only white person.
That makes me kind of crazy. I actually had a friend who said he was taking his kids out of city schools and moving to the suburbs because he didn't want his daughters to be the minority children in the classroom. And I mean, that's a very personal decision, but it made me sad because I thought, well, if it's wrong to, what are we saying when we're saying that it's tough to be in the minority? Are we saying that as, you know, white Americans should no longer have the expectation of being the majority? I don't think we are anymore. We're certainly should be open to that. And I worked for a long time at the Baltimore Sun. And I'm just going to put this out there. And this was during a time when the Baltimore Sun was very well regarded. The Baltimore Sun had one of the most abysmal hiring records when it came to African Americans. The numbers were appalling, especially when you consider that it's the Baltimore Sun. a city that really had an interest in finding and recruiting and bringing up young African-American reporters. It's important. And if you tried to talk to the bosses about it, there was no acknowledgement that there was a problem. It was always, well, you know, I just hire people I feel comfortable with. Like, but the people you feel comfortable with are exactly like you. And what this is about people not wanting to be conscious of other people's backgrounds and sensitivities and different opinions, of just wanting to feel safe and not having to, you know, people should think about what they say. And that's not anti-First Amendment. It's not censorious. Is that even a word? I don't know.
I
just know that there's no harm in thinking carefully about the things you say. I'll go off on a tangent here. I was actually slightly in front of this because it's now a public service announcement, but I recently began a campaign among my circle of acquaintances that using the word gay as like a slur or as a synonym for that's stupid, that's lame, that it was just unacceptable. And I'd never really thought about it. It wasn't like I used it so much, but I was surrounded by it. And what happened is Hank Stuever, I think I'm pronouncing his, I might be mispronouncing his last name. He's a writer for the Washington Post. He's gay. Around the time the movie Milk came out, he wrote about what it was like to watch the straight actors, James Franco in particular, go on talk shows and have straight talk show hosts ask him, wasn't it awful to have to kiss a guy? And like laugh at it and kind of, you know, like, oh my God. And he said, you know, this is a country where actors routinely are asked to pretend to blow people's heads off and they don't go on talk shows and have people. And he said, you know, and I just thought, wow, okay. This this is something where, you know, you'll find enlightened people who have a hard time letting go of this behavior once you start noticing it. And I just think it's a kind of emotional laziness of not wanting to think about other people, of wanting to have everyone be just like you, because that just takes less thought. And I say this as someone who I think at times in my life I've said the wrong thing. I've said unthinking and insensitive things and had to sort of play the tape back. And I'm like, what the heck? You know, that's not acceptable. And, you know, I think it comes back to this idea that, you know, from within a group, you can make certain jokes. There's certain sexist humor that I feel I'm absolutely entitled to.
As a woman.
As a woman, I get to make that joke. As a man, you don't. And I think there are certain terms and jokes that within a group one is allowed to make, and from outside the group, sorry, it's off limits. So, okay, the Tony Awards were Sunday night, and it ends with Neil Patrick Harris, an out actor, singing a song written by two gay lyricists, where there are a lot of jokes about how gay the Tonys are. That I'm comfortable with, because
gay men wrote it. A gay man
is performing it, and gay men. And so if they want to have a line, it was actually hilarious. Like, this show could not be any gayer if Liza Minnelli were mayor, and and Elton John took flight. That's okay. Their joke, they get to make it. Off limits to me. And I think what you find is, Baltimore just has this problem. We don't ever talk about it, but Baltimore has a problem with segregation, you know, within our social lives. So I like to go to the farmer's market under the JFX.
On Sunday morning,
because it is the most integrated public arena in Baltimore in terms of race and class. It is the most diverse group of people you find doing the same thing harmoniously in Baltimore that I know of. I can't.
It doesn't happen often. Another place I thought is our print partners are the Urbanite, is the Urbanite magazine. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of work with them now. and their first of the month party to celebrate the coming out of the issue is one of those places. I'm shocked that it actually happens, but it does. But in some ways, your novel and what you're exploring here in Life Sentences, I mean, I haven't really thought about it until I actually just had this conversation just now, but it makes sense to me. Maybe we'll see. Is that this is, in some ways, your exploration of that crossing the boundaries, too?
Yes. I think that's, I mean, yes. I wanted Cassandra to be that clueless person. And in that way, she's a bit of an everywoman. I wanted to write about someone who has a mirror held up. Someone who, if Cassandra's confident about anything, it's sort of, she's without bias. No one can ever call her a bigot. You know, she had a black stepmother at a time when that was a pretty darn unusual thing to have when your dad, you know.
Right.
And to see that, and there's this one moment, I'm thinking a bit about Tina, the white former cop who's now a sales associate at Nordstrom.
Right.
And she has this conversation with her neighbor, who's a man of a different generation.
Oh, the older Italian guy.
Yeah. And she realizes someone has come to see her, has dropped by her house.
Right.
And she thinks it might be this woman, Callie, an African-American woman who is sort of her, you know, her Moby Dick in a way, the thing that she chased and never got. And she realizes it's unthinkable to her older white neighbor that she could have a friend who's not white. That it just doesn't, that
right.
doesn't compute for him because he's an older Italian-American man. She's also Italian-American. And, you know, those little moments were important to sort of just, you know, I sometimes get in trouble writing about race in that my books go off to New York and where everybody's in publishing is liberal and pretty much everybody's mm-hmm. white. And sometimes they don't like the way the people in my books talk.
Because?
It makes them uncomfortable. I'll tell you a funny story. I've always thought it was hilarious. When I wrote the first book outside of my series, Every Secret Thing, there are two white cops.
Right.
And they've gone off and they've interviewed a white woman who has a black boyfriend. And they have a child together.
Right.
And when they come back, they're just having two colleagues sitting around. And the male cop asked the female cop. She's married. It's not like she's out there looking. He says, would you date a black guy? And he goes like, and in the book, the way I originally read it, he said, I'm not saying someone like that guy. I said, I'm not saying that guy who didn't deserve to win the Oscar or something like that. He said, I'm like talking like a guy in Vice. Would you? And she says, yes. Even though she's kind of thinking, well, no, I probably wouldn't. But that's just because I like blondes. You know, like she can't.
Right.
And I got this note from my editor saying, this really bothers people that you're suggesting that Denzel Washington didn't deserve to win the Oscar.
Oh, no.
Like, okay. First of all, I'm not saying that. This guy, Kevin Infante, who's originally from Long Island, who's probably got who says all sorts of horrible things about women and other races, he said it. And I was like, that's how people talk. I mean, and they said, and I was,
right.
What they, and then here's the Trump card. They said, well, people up here who are reading this wondered if you, in fact, were racist. And, you know, that totally puts you on the defensive. It's like, okay, now I have to rewrite it because I've been called a racist because one of my characters is, in fact, a racist. But I just thought that was so hilarious that they were disturbed that I was suggesting. By the way, I think Denzel Washington did, in fact, deserve the Oscar. Those were not my opinions. Those were the opinions of one Kevin Infante. So, you know, these conversations about race, they're so hard to have. It was, again, going back to the Baltimore Sun, I felt that there were things as an institution, as a newsroom, we were a little bit tone deaf on at times. I mean,
yep.
You know, praise the Lord that we had a reporter like Mike Fletcher there covering Schmoke at the Evening Sun. That matters. I mean, I'm not saying that you have to have an African-American reporter to cover an African-American mayor. But I'm saying that there are things that you don't know about other people. I was always very moved by, I had a boss for a time at the Baltimore Sun named Mike Adams.
I know Mike Adams. Yeah.
First time Mike Adams ever came to the Sun to talk about getting a job there, according to the story he told me, he walked in off the street cold, and he asked the receptionist, who would I talk to about getting a job as a reporter? And the woman said to him, if you want to be a porter, you go up to the train station.
Lord have mercy.
That story is a universe. And the white male job applicant who has never been told to go to the train station to apply for work as a porter needs to know that story and needs to work alongside people who have these stories. And what your callers today have talked about is a world in which people are shutting themselves off from those stories, from those experiences, not because they're bad people, but because it makes them uncomfortable. Because it's that, okay, well, what do I do about this? Well, you know what you do? You listen and you pay attention and you heed the fact that there's so many different ways of being in our world. I wanted to show in this book that there's not just one way of... Here are these five women. One white, actually, five altogether. Four African-American. No two lives exactly alike. One, Cassandra's right. Been divorced twice. Tisha is happily married. Donna's been divorced and is remarried. Right. Fatima is a good time girl who's reinvented herself. Callie has never married and has born two children who are lost to her. We know that much. And there's no harm in just opening your ears and listening to other people's stories.
And what we've never really done talked about is the mystery in all this. Since it is a mystery novel.
I know. It's kind of funny because it is a mystery novel. I mean, it is a story about Cassandra decides she's going to find out what happened to this classmate of hers who was accused of doing something awful to her child, but nothing is ever proven and nothing is ever known. And she does find out the answers, but she finds out that's not the most important answer in all the things she's searching for. And the most important mystery was one that's been staring her in her face most of her life that she never had the courage to look at.
And then there's the whole subtext of Greek mythology that runs through the book as well.
Yes. it's value-packed.
It's value-packed. Let's try. Can we get one more caller here? Very, very fast. Very fast. Dave in Baltimore, we don't have much. We have 60 seconds. Try to leave you on. What's up?
Mark and Laura, race, sex, violence, and we have such a deafening silence. You guys keep on talking. I congratulate you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. We are out of time, but let me just say that Life Sentences, Laura Lippman, is from my vote, and Valerie's as well, which is the other half of my life, the best book that Laura Lippman's ever written, and they've all been great. This has been a phenomenal book, and if you're looking for something to read, read it. It's just great. I love this. Laura, great to see you.
Oh, great to be here.
Thanks a lot.
Great
Thank
hour.
You. Thank you. The Mark Steiner, remind you, Urbanite Radio stories on The Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce, business and workplace conflicts, located right here in Baltimore. Go to BaltimoreMediation.com. We're taking a short break. Come right back and hear a fascinating story about the life of I.F. Stone. If you don't know who he is, stay tuned to find out. One of the most fantastic journalists ever lived in our lifetime. We'll be right back.